They hanged John Farrell in the dawn, amid the marketplace. At dusk came Adam Brand to him and spat upon his face. O neighbors all, spake Adam Brand, see ye John Farrell's fate. 'Tis proven here, a hempen noose is stronger than man's hate. For hear ye not John Farrell's vow to be avenged upon me? Come life or death, see how he hangs high on the gallows tree. Yet never a word the people spoke, in fear and wild surprise, for the grisly corpse raised up its head and stared with sightless eyes, and with strange motion, slow and stiff, pointed at Adam Brand, and clambered down the gibbet tree, the noose within its hand. With gaping mouth stood Adam Brand like a statue carved of stone. To the dead man lay a clammy hand hard upon his shoulder bone. Then Adam shrieked like a soul in hell, the red blood left his face, and he reeled away in a drunken run through the screaming marketplace. And close behind, the dead man came with a face like a mummy's mask, and the dead joints cracked and the stiff legs creaked with their unwonted task. Men fled before the flying twain, or shrank with bated breath, and they saw on the face of Adam Brand the seal set there by death. He reeled on buckling legs that failed, yet on and on he fled. So through the shuddering marketplace, the dying fled the dead. At the riverside fell Adam Brand with a scream that rent the skies. Across him fell John Farrell's corpse, nor ever the twain did rise. There was no wound on Adam Brand, but his brow was cold and damp, for the fear of death had blown out his life as a witch blows out a lamp. His lips were writhed in a horrid grin like a fiend's on Satan's coals, and the men that looked on his face that day, his stare still haunts their souls. Such was the fate of Adam Brand, a strange, unearthly fate, for stronger than death or hempen noose are the fires of a dead man's hate. Good evening, listeners. This is Professor Jonas Armitage, and you're listening to Stories from Dark Places. Tonight's poem is called The Dead Man's Hate. It's the work of Robert Irvin Howard. Tonight's story continues to be The King in Yellow by Robert Chambers. Before we get on with our night's entertainment, I would like to speak on something. There's been a lot of news lately about prejudices and violence against members of Asian descent, not even those born there and migrated to the United States, but to those born in the United States from that cultural, historical descent. I feel obligated to say something. You have no right or reason to persecute anyone in this country for their color, race, religion, gender, identity, preferences, or creed. America itself was founded on the principles of acceptance. It was to be the mixing pot. And considering that the predominantly Caucasian race stole it from indigenous tribes through acts of violence, it seems a little hypocritical of you, doesn't it, to persecute others for coming here looking for the opportunities. But I'm told that this persecution is because that those from China and other Asian countries are responsible for COVID somehow. Please be clear. They are no more accountable for COVID than the citizens of Spain were for the Spanish flu. It is an illness, and it does not come based from origin. The threat and the problem to be addressed lies in the hands of those in power who make decisions that influence us all. So if you want to be angry at someone, turn to the former administration, or turn to the current one, and tell them you expect better. Now, I'll get off my soapbox, and we will get to tonight's story, right after a message from our sponsors.
Hi, this is Danielle from WZHP. When I'm looking for a comfortable place to take the whole family to eat dinner, but I don't want to break the bank, I go to Abby's. Serving the downtown Innsmouth area since 1957, Abby's is a rustic diner that specializes in American comfort food. Whether it's those deep-fried peanut butter and pickle sandwiches you saw in that diner food show, or niche northern cuisine like Alaskan skinheads, or even if you just want a hot slice of stargazy pie. Abby's has it all. Abby's, on the corner of Martins Avenue and 12th Street West. Show your membership to Marsh Hall and get a slice of stargazy pie a la mode on the house.
Part 2.
I climbed the 3 dilapidated flights of stairs, which I had so often climbed before, and knocked at a small door at the end of the corridor. Mr. Wilde opened the door, and I walked in. When he had double-locked the door and pushed a heavy chest against it, he came and sat down beside me, peering up into my face with his little light-colored eyes. Half a dozen new scratches covered his nose and cheeks, and the silver wires which supported his artificial ears had become displaced. I thought I had never seen him so hideously fascinating. He had no ears. The artificial ones, which now stood out at an angle from the fine wire, were his one weakness. They were made of wax and painted a shell pink, but the rest of his face was yellow. He might better have reveled in the luxury of some artificial fingers for his left hand, which was absolutely fingerless, but it seemed to cause him no inconvenience, and he was satisfied with his wax ears. He was very small, scarcely higher than a child of 10, but his arms were magnificently developed, and his thighs as thick as any athlete's. Still, the most remarkable thing about Mr. Wilde was that a man of his marvelous intelligence and knowledge should have such a head. It was flat and pointed, like the heads of many of those unfortunates whom people imprison in asylums for the weak-minded. Many called him insane, but I knew him to be as sane as I was. I do not deny that he was eccentric. The mania he had for keeping that cat and teasing her until she flew at his face like a demon was certainly eccentric. I never could understand why he kept the creature, nor what pleasure he found in shutting himself up in his room with this surly, vicious beast. I remember once glancing up from the manuscript I was studying by the light of some tallow dips, and seeing Mr. Wilde squatting motionless on his high chair, his eyes fairly blazing with excitement, while the cat, which had risen from her place before the stove, came creeping across the ground right at him. Before I could move, she flattened her belly to the ground, crouched, trembled, and sprang into his face. Howling and foaming, they rolled over and over on the floor, scratching and clawing, until the cat screamed and fled under the cabinet, and Mr. Wilde turned over on his back, his limbs contracting and curling up like the legs of a dying spider. He was eccentric. Mr. Wilde had climbed into his high chair, and, after studying my face, picked up his dog-eared ledger and opened it.
"Henry B. Matthews," he read. "Bookkeeper with Wyscott, Wyscott and Company, dealers in church ornaments. Called April 3rd. Reputation damaged on the racetrack. Known as a welcher. Reputation to be repaired by August 1st. Retainer, $5.
He turned the page and ran his fingerless knuckles down the closely written columns.
"P. Green Dunsbury, minister of the gospel, Fairbeach, New Jersey. Reputation damaged in the Bowery. To be repaired as soon as possible. Retainer, $100.
He coughed and added,
"Called April 6th.
"Well, then you are not in need of money, Mr. Wilde," I inquired.
"Listen," he coughed again. "Mrs. C. Hamilton Chester of Chester Park, New York City. Called April 7th. Reputation damaged at Dieppe, France. To be repaired by October 1st. Retainer, $500. Note, C. Hamilton Chester, Captain USS Avalanche, ordered home from South Sea Squadron, October 1st.
"Well," I said, "the profession of a repairer of reputations is lucrative." His colorless eyes sought mine.
"I only wanted to demonstrate that I was correct. You said it was impossible to succeed as a repairer of reputations, that even if I did succeed in certain cases it would cost me more than I would gain by it. Today I have 500 men in my employ, who are poorly paid, but who pursue the work with an enthusiasm, which possibly may be born of fear. These men enter every shade and grade of society. Some even are pillars of the most exclusive social temples. Others are the prop and pride of the financial world. Still others hold undisputed sway among the fancy and the talent. I choose them at my leisure for those who reply to my advertisements. It is easy enough. They are all cowards. I could tremble the number in 20 days if I wished. So you see, these who have in their keeping the reputations of their fellow citizens, I have in my pay.
They may turn on you, I suggested.
He rubbed his thumb over his cropped ears and adjusted the wax substitutes.
I think not, he murmured thoughtfully. I seldom have to apply the whip, and then only once. Besides, they like their wages.
How do you apply the whip? I demanded. His face for a moment was awful to look upon. His eyes dwindled to a pair of green sparks.
I invite them to come and have a little chat with me, he said in a soft voice.
A knock on the door interrupted him, and his face resumed its amiable expression.
Who is it?
He inquired.
Mr. Stillett, was the answer. Come tomorrow, replied Mr. Wilde.
Impossible, began the other, but was silenced by a sort of bark from Mr. Wilde.
Come tomorrow,
he repeated. We heard someone move away from the door and turn the corner by the stairway.
Who's that? I asked. Arnold Stillett, owner and editor-in-chief of the Great New York Daily.
He drummed on the ledger with his fingerless hands, adding,
I pay him very badly, but he thinks it a good bargain.
Arnold Stillett, I repeated, amazed.
Yes,
said Mr. Wilde, with a self-satisfied cough. The cat, which had entered the room as he spoke, hesitated, looked up at him and snarled. He climbed down from the chair and squatted on the floor, took the creature into his arms and caressed her. The cat ceased snarling and presently began a loud purring, which seemed to increase in timbre as he stroked her. Where are the notes? I asked. He pointed to the table, and for the 100th time I picked up the bundle of manuscript entitled The Imperial Dynasty of America. One by one I studied the well-worn pages, worn only by my own handling, and although I knew all by heart from the beginning, when from Carcosa, the Hyades, Hastur, and Aldebaran, to Castaigne, Louis de Calvados, born December 19, 1877. I read it with an eager, rapt attention, pausing to repeat parts of it aloud, and dwelling especially on Hildred de Calvados, only son of Hildred Castaigne and Edelith Landis Castaigne, first in succession, etc., etc. When I finished, Mr. Wilde nodded and coughed.
Speaking to your legitimate ambition, he said, how do Constance and Louis get along?
She loves him, I replied simply. The cat on his knee suddenly turned and struck at his eyes, and he flung her off and climbed onto the chair opposite me.
And Dr. Archer, but that's a matter you can settle any time you wish, he added.
Yes, I replied, Dr. Archer can wait, but it's time I saw my cousin Louis.
It is time, he repeated.
Then he took another ledger from the table and ran over the leaves rapidly.
We are now in communication with 10,000 men, he muttered. We can count on 100,000 within the first 28 hours, and in 48 hours the state will rise en masse. The country follows the state. The portion that will not, I mean California and the Northwest, might better never have been inhabited. I shall not send them the yellow sign.
The blood rushed to my head, but I only answered, A new broom sweeps clean.
The ambitions of Caesar and of Napoleon pale before that which could not rest until it has seized the minds of men and controlled even their unborn thoughts, said Mr. Wilde.
You're speaking of the king in yellow, I groaned, with a shudder.
He is a king whose emperors have served.
I am content to serve him, I replied. Mr. Wilde sat rubbing his ears with his crippled hand.
Perhaps Constance does not love him, he suggested.
I started to reply, but a sudden burst of military music from the street below drowned my voice. The 20th Dragoon Regiment, formerly in garrison at Mount St. Vincent, was returning from maneuvers in Westchester County to its new barracks in Eastern Washington Square. It was my cousin's regiment. They were a fine lot of fellows in their pale blue, tight-fitting jackets, jaunty busbies and white riding breeches with a double yellow stripe into which their limbs seemed molded. But every other squadron was armed with lances, from the metal points of which fluttered yellow and white pennons. The band passed, playing the regimental march that came the colonel and the staff, the horses crowding and trampling with their heads bobbing in unison, and the pennons fluttered from their lance points. The troopers, who rode with the beautiful English seat, looked brown as berries from their bloodless campaign among the farms of Westchester, and the music of their sabers against the stirrups and the jingle of spurs and carbines was delightful to me. I saw Lewis riding with his squadron. He was as handsome as an officer as I've ever seen. Mr. Wilde, who had mounted a chair by the window, saw him too, but said nothing. Lewis turned and looked straight at Hawberk's shop as he passed, and I could see the flush on his brown cheeks. I think Constance must have been at the window. When the last troopers had clattered by and the last pennons vanished into South Fifth Avenue, Mr. Wilde clambered out of his chair and dragged the chest away from the door.
"Yes," he said, "it is time that you saw your cousin Lewis."
He unlocked the door, and I picked up my hat and stick and stepped into the corridor. The stairs were dark. Groping about, I set my foot on something soft, which snarled and spit, and I aimed a murderous blow at the cat, but my cane shivered to splinters against the balustrade, and the beast scurried back into Mr. Wilde's room. Passing Auberg's door again, I saw him still at work on the armor, but I did not stop, and stepped out onto Bleecker Street. I followed it to Wooster, skirted the grounds of the Lethal Chamber, and crossing Washington Park, went straight to my room in the Benedict. Here I lunched comfortably, read the Herald and the Meteor, and finally went to the steel safe in my bedroom and set the time combination. 3¾ minutes, which it is necessary to wait while the time lock is opening, are to me golden moments. From the instant I set the combination to the moment when I grasp the knobs and swing back those solid steel doors, I live in an ecstasy of expectation. Those moments must be moments past in paradise. I know what I am defined at the end of the time limit. I know what the massive safe holds secure for me alone, and the exquisite pleasure of waiting is hardly enhanced when the safe opens and I lift, from its velvet crown, a diadem of purest gold blazing with diamonds. I do this every day, and yet the joy of waiting, and at last touching again the diadem, only seems to increase as the days pass. It is a diadem fit for a king among kings, an emperor among emperors. The king in yellow might scorn it, but it shall be worn by his royal servant. I held it in my arms until the alarms in the safe rang harshly, and then tenderly, proudly, I replaced it and shut the steel doors. I walked slowly back into my study, which faces Washington Square, and leaned on the windowsill. The afternoon sun poured into my windows, and a gentle breeze stirred the branches of the elms and maples in the park, now covered with buds and tender foliage. A flock of pigeons circled about the tower of the memorial church, sometimes alighting on the purple-tiled roof, sometimes wheeling downward to the lotus fountain in front of the marble arch. The gardeners were busy with the flower beds around the fountain, and the freshly turned earth smelt sweet and spicy. A lawnmower, drawn by a fat white horse, clinked across the greensward, and watering carts poured showers of spray over the asphalt drives. Around the statue of Peter Stuyvesant, which in 1897 had replaced the monstrosity supposed to represent Garibaldi, children played in the spring sunshine, and nurse girls wheeled elaborate baby carriages with a reckless disregard for the pasty-faced occupants, which could probably be explained by the presence of half a dozen trim dragoon troopers languidly lolling on the benches. Through the trees, the Washington Memorial Arch glistened like silver in the sunshine, and beyond, on the eastern extremity of the square, the gray stone barracks of the dragoons and the white granite artillery stables were alive with color and motion. I looked at the lethal chamber on the corner of the square opposite. A few curious people still lingered about the gilded iron railing, but inside the ground the paths were deserted. I watched the fountains ripple and sparkle. The sparrows had already found this new bathing nook, and the basins were covered with the dusty feathered little things. Two or three white peacocks picked their way across the lawns, and a drab-colored pigeon sat so motionless on the arm of one of the fates that it seemed to be part of the sculptured stone. As I was turning carelessly away, a slight commotion in the group of curious loiterers around the gates attracted my attention. A young man had entered and was advancing with nervous strides across the gravel path which leads to the bronze doors of the lethal chamber. He paused a moment before the fates, and as he raised his head to those three mysterious faces, the pigeon rose from its sculpted perch, circled about for a moment, and wheeled to the east. The young man pressed his face to his hands, and then, with an undefinable gesture, sprang upon the marble steps. The bronze doors closed behind him, and half an hour later the loiterer slouched away, and the frightened pigeon returned to his perch in the arms of fate. I put on my hat and went out to the park for a little walk before dinner. As I crossed the central driveway, a group of officers passed. One of them called out, "Hello, Hildred," and came back to shake hands with me. It was my cousin Lewis, who stood smiling and tapped his spurred heels with his riding whip. "Just back from Westchester," he said. "Been doing the bucolic, milk and curds, you know, dairymaids and sunbonnets who say, 'Hell,' and 'I don't think,' when you tell them they're pretty. I'm nearly dead for a square meal in Delmonico's. What's the news?" "There's nothing," I replied pleasantly. "I saw your regiment come in this morning."
"Did you? I didn't see you. Where were you?"
"In Mr. Wilde's window."
"Oh, hell," he began impatiently. "That man is stark mad. I don't understand why you..."
He saw how annoyed I felt by this outburst and begged my pardon.
"Really, old chap," he said, "I don't mean to run down a man you like, but for the life of me I can't see what the deuce you find in common with Mr. Wilde. He's not well bred, to put it generously. He's hideously deformed. His head is the head of a criminally insane person. You yourself know that he's been in an asylum."
"So have I interrupted calmly. Lewis looked startled and confused for a moment, but recovered and slapped me heartily on the shoulder.
"You were completely cured," he began, but I stopped him again.
"I suppose you mean that I was simply acknowledged never to have been insane?"
"Well, of course, that's what I meant," he laughed.
I disliked his laugh because I knew it was forced. But I nodded gaily and asked him where he was going. Lewis looked after his brother officers, who had now almost reached Broadway. We had intended to sample a Brunswick cocktail, but to tell you the truth, I was anxious for an excuse to go see Hauberk instead. "Come along, I'll make you my excuse." We found old Hauberk, nearly attired in a fresh spring suit, standing at the door of his shop and sniffing the air.
"I just decided to take Constance for a little stroll before dinner," he replied to the impetuous volley of questions from Lewis. "We thought of walking to the park terrace along the North River."
At that moment, Constance appeared and grew pale and rosy by turns as Lewis bent over her small gloved fingers. I tried to excuse myself, alleging an engagement uptown, but Lewis and Constance would not listen, and I saw I was expected to remain and engage old Hauberk's attention. After all, it would be just as well if I kept my eye on Lewis, I thought. And when they hailed a Spring Street horse car, I got in after them and took my seat beside the armorer. The beautiful line of parks and granite terraces overlooking the wharves along the North River, built in 1910 and finished in the autumn of 1917, had become one of the most popular promenades in the metropolis. They extended from the Battery on 190th Street, overlooking the noble river and affording a fine view of the Jersey Shore and the Highlands opposite. Cafes and restaurants were scattered here and there among the trees, and twice a week military bands from the garrison played in the kiosks on the parapets. We sat down in the sunshine on the beach, at the foot of the equestrian statue of General Sheridan. Constance tipped her sunshade to shield her eyes, and she and Lewis began a murmuring conversation which was impossible to catch. Old Hauberk, leaning on his ivory-headed cane, lighted an excellent cigar, the mate of which I politely refused, and smiled at vacancy. The sun hung low above the Staten Island woods, and the bay was dyed with golden hues, reflected from the sun-warm sails of the shipping in the harbor. Brigs, schooners, yachts, clumsy ferry boats, their decks swarming with people, railroad transports carrying lines of brown, blue, and white freight cars, stately sound steamers, déclassé tramp steamers, coasters, dredgers, scows, and everywhere pervading the entire bay, impudent little tugs puffing and whistling officiously. These were the craft which churned the sunlit waters as far as the eye could reach. In calm contrast to the hurry of sailing vessels and steamers, a silent fleet of white warships lay motionless in midstream. Constance's merry laugh aroused me from my reverie.
"What are you staring at?" she required.
"Nothing. The fleet," I smiled. Then Lewis told us that the vessels were, pointing out each by its relative position to the old fort on Governor's Island.
"The little cigar-shaped thing is a torpedo boat," he explained. "There are four more lying close together. There are the Tarpon, the Falcon, the Sea Fox, and the Octopus. The gunboats just above the Princeton, the Champlain, the Stillwaters, and the Erie. Next to them lie the cruisers Farragut and Los Angeles. And above them the battleships California and Dakota, and the Washington, which is the flagship. Those two squatty-looking chunks of metal which are anchored there off Castle William are the double-turreted monitors Terrible and Magnificent. Behind them lies the ram, Osceola, Constance looked at him with deep approval in her beautiful eyes. "What loads of things you know for a soldier," she said, and we all joined in the laugh which followed. Presently, Lewis rose with a nod to us and offered his arm to Constance, and they strolled away along the river walk. Hawberk watched them for a moment and then turned to me.
"Mr. Wilde was right," he said. "I found the missing tassets in the left cassard of the Prince Emblazoned and a vile old junk garret in Pell Street."
998, I inquired with a smile.
"Yes."
"Mr. Wilde is a very intelligent man," I observed.
I want to give him the credit for this most important discovery," continued Hawberk, "and I intend it shall be known that he is entitled to the fame of it."
"He won't thank you for that," I answered sharply. "Please say nothing of it."
"Do you know what it is worth?" said Hawberk.
$50, perhaps."
"It is valued at 500, but the owner of the Prince's Emblazoned will give $2,000 to the person who completes his suit. That reward also belongs to Mr. Wilde."
"He doesn't want it. He refuses it," I answered angrily.
"What do you know about Mr. Wilde? He doesn't need the money. He's rich, or will be richer than any living man except myself. What will we care for money, then, when... will we care, he and I, when... when...
when what?" demanded Hawberk, astonished.
"You will see," I replied, on my guard again.
He looked at me narrowly, much as Dr. Archer used to, and I knew he thought I was mentally unsound. Perhaps it was fortunate for him that he did not use the word lunatic just then.
"No," I replied to his unspoken thought, "I'm not mentally weak. My mind is as healthy as Mr. Wilde's. I do not care to explain just yet what I have on hand, but it is an investment which will pay more than mere gold, silver, and precious stones. It will secure the happiness and prosperity of a continent, yes, a hemisphere."
"Oh," said Hawberk.
"And eventually," I continued more quietly, "it will secure the happiness of the whole world."
"And incidentally, your own happiness and prosperity as well as Mr. Wilde's?"
"Exactly," I smiled.
But I could have throttled him for taking that tone. He looked at me in silence for a while, and then said very gently, "Why don't you give up your books and studies, Mr. Castaigne, and take a tramp along the mountains somewhere or other? You used to be fond of fishing. Take a cast or two at the trouts in the Wrangleys."
"I don't care for fishing anymore," I answered, without a shade of annoyance in my voice.
"You used to be fond of everything," he continued. "Athletics, yachting, shooting, riding."
"I've never cared for rides since my fall," I said quietly.
"Ah, yes, your fall," he replied, looking away from me. I thought this nonsense had gone far enough, so I brought the conversation back to Mr. Wilde, but he was scanning my face again in a manner highly offensive to me.
"Mr. Wilde," he repeated, "do you know what he did this afternoon? He came downstairs and nailed a sign over the hall down next to mine. It read, 'Mr. Wilde, Repairer of Reputations, Third Bell.'"
"Do you know what a repairer of reputations can be?"
"I do," I replied, suppressing the rage within.
"Oh," he said again. Lewis and Constance came strolling by and stopped to ask if we would join them. Hawberk looked at his watch. At the same moment, a puff of smoke shot from the casemates of Castle William, and the boom of the sunset gun rolled across the water and was re-echoed from the highlands opposite. The flag came running down the flagpole. The bugles sounded on the white decks of the warships, and the first electric light sparked out of the Jersey shore. As I turned into the city with Hawberk, I heard Constance murmuring something to Lewis which I did not understand, but Lewis whispered, "My darling," in reply. And again, walking ahead with Hawberk through the square, I heard a murmur of "Sweetheart," my own Constance, and I knew the time had nearly arrived when I should speak of important matters with my cousin Lewis. Cousin Lewis.
An interesting tale for certain. Who is this Mr. Wilde? Where does his information come from? And what is this great plan that they have laid? The answers to this will be delivered unto you in the next segment of our story. But that's all the time we have for now. Join us next week when the truth of this tale comes to its end and we are delivered a most unexpected end to all ends. Good night, listeners. And as you tuck yourselves in tonight, turn off your lamps. You hear the quiet rustle in the hall, the pitter-patter of footsteps, the rasp
of something as it crosses the threshold of your bedroom door. Remember this. There's nothing to be afraid of. After all, some of the best things only happen in the dark.
Stories from Dark Places was recorded before an imaginary studio audience. All stories performed on this podcast have express written consent from the original author, Jonas Armitage, his studio manager, and the entire staff of WZHP Radio Innsmouth are fictitious characters, and it's probably for the best that you continue to believe that.
Hello, listeners. Looking for more tales to entertain with esoteric delight and supernatural suspense? I would encourage you to check out Peculiar Stories. Join Indiana Beckett as she takes you on a walk around her particular side of the neighborhood in all things strange and unusual. You may find her on Anchor Podcasts or anywhere that your podcast can be found.